at issue here are three treatment events that occurred in August of 1994, March of 1997, and September of 1998. The complaint in the case was filed in July of 1999. Following extensive discovery, scheduling the case for trial, pretrial order, the court below granted summary judgment, holding as a matter of law that the case was time barred by the statute of limitations. First, to the extent the September 1998 treatment is viable as an act of negligence, then clearly the complaint was filed within the two-year period. The more difficult question, the thornier part of the case, is going back to 1997 and to 1994. It's our contention that despite the time lapse here, we are talking about a single series of treatments by the same healthcare provider involving the same condition, namely a brain tumor that went undiagnosed on these three separate occasions. The last treatment event occurred at Kent General Hospital and clearly refers back to the 1994 MRI and the history that the patient had presented.
In that regard, Mr. Castle, when she was there in 98, was that the worst case scenario? In other words, she was being treated because she was in the emergency room. But as I understood the representations in the brief, no one was contending anything that happened in 1998 was negligent, or they didn't recommend some follow-up after she was in the emergency room in 1998 that was negligent. Is that correct?
That's not exactly right, Gerard. Dr. Vera Pappas saw her in the emergency room in 1998 on two occasions, on the 14th and 15th of September. He tentatively diagnosed her condition as being related to hormonal changes because of her pregnancy. That we contend is negligence. He did not immediately refer her to a neurosurgeon or immediately order an MRI. And in fact, the next day it was her obstetrician who took charge, had her moved to Christiana, and that's when the appropriate referral did take place and the diagnosis was made by Dr. Boulos. But we do contend that the handling of the patient in the emergency room was below standard.
So that's critical to your position in this case, that on that first trip to the emergency room in 98, your allegation is that there was a problem in the treatment.
Yes, sir. The other side of that coin, of course, is that the causation, the damages traceable to that, are de minimis in one sense, because it was diagnosed 6 weeks later, October 24th. And technically, we have an argument that the continued presence of the tumor, the continued growth of the tumor, was damage, but it is by far the smallest part of the case in terms of overall damage. And in order for the case to have any meaning, it would have to go back and capture the 1997 deviation and the 1994 deviation.
Mr. Castle, can you help us find record support for an inference or a finding that there was a violation of the standard of care when Dr. Vera Pappas saw her at Kent General in 1998?
In the pretrial order, Your Honor, which appears at A52, A53 of our appendix, which I should have here, there are at least five separate references to acts of negligence between 1994 and 1998, including on page A52, the defendant's section of the pretrial order describing the case states this is a medical malpractice and loss of consortium action arising out of defendant's treatment of plaintiff Tammy Stafford between 1994 and 1998. And the ongoing discovery in the case had been dealing with that throughout. It's true that the original complaint did not make that allegation. But the pretrial order in at least five places refers to negligent acts between 94 and 98.
And when the judge ruled, the judge pointed that out, and there was some discussion about whether you could amend your complaint, and that application was denied. Is that correct?
At that time, and to be candid with the court, we were caught flat-footed, and there was no discussion at the time of Judge Tolliver's ruling about the pretrial order and what was contained in it, and what we had all assumed was going to be part of the case we tried the following week.
Your position, then, is that as far as the 1998 episode is concerned, the allegations in the pretrial order operated to amend the complaint.
That's correct.
As a matter of law.
Yes.
My question goes to the common thread that that links what otherwise are argued to be, and I think what were found to be, isolated episodes that took place between 1994 and 1998. Is the common thread that beginning back in 94 there was a failure to institute a proper diagnostic procedures which would have led to an earlier discovery of the tumor?
Yes, and it could have been done in August of 94, or it certainly could have been done 6 months later when the records indicate that she was to be scheduled for another MRI, which never happened.
Yes, and that, according to your opponent, is attributable to her. Is that correct?
That's what my opponent says is correct. That's not what we can see. Two parts to that, Your Honor. Number one, if the doctor was going to order an MRI 6 months later, there was some obligation on the part of the doctor to do that and to remind the patient to do it. And the record is devoid of anything like that. And the second part of it is, Ms. Stafford has no memory of any of these events because of her brain injury. So she has to just sit on the sidelines and listen to this discussion. She can't contribute herself. But we contend that the record indicates that there was a failure on the part of the healthcare provider to follow through in 94. And then in 97, when they had another opportunity, they knew or should have known that 6 month MRI had never been ordered, and yet they didn't order it.
Is the presence or absence of, I don't know if doctrine is the right word, but the concept of continuing negligent medical treatment, is that inherently a fact question for a jury, or is that something that can be disposed of on summary judgment just as easily?
Our position is that the doctrine as enunciated by Justice Holland in Ewing versus Beck sets out the parameters. It's a broad rule, and everything after that is a fact question.
I appreciate the credit, but our court works in groups. So when all the opinions are attributable to everybody who was on the panel, but as I understand it here, with regard to the event that would determine the statute of limitations, you really need to find something that happened in 1998, assuming there was a course of continuous treatment. So let's go back to Justice Steele's question about what Dr. Varapappas did on that first day. What is it that he did that the record reflects was a violation of the standard of care when he was on call, so to speak, and was asked to come into the emergency room? What was the negligence?
He did not seek a neurosurgical consult. He has a neurosurgeon in his group. Did not do that. Did not immediately order an MRI, and attributed her seizure problem to hormonal changes because she was pregnant. Now,
none of that, though, is in the complaint.
That's correct.
But is in the pretrial order?
It's in the pretrial order in broad terms, and it's in the medical record, and some of those documents have been attached to the appendix.
Well,
so is the problem here not permitting you to amend your complaint then?
No. The way the case unfolded and discovery proceeded, this was part of the ongoing factual disagreement. and we captured it in broad language in the pretrial order. And there was never any focus on the complaint. And we take the position that Your Honor just mentioned about the pretrial order supersedes the pleadings and controls.
Well, it's not unusual in negligence cases for more particularized facts to be developed through discovery than anyone's on notice about at the time the complaint's filed. Isn't that true?
Especially so in medical negligence cases, Your Honor.
Do I have it right that, back in 94, that there was enough information available about this patient that it was that ordering an MRI was warranted?
Well, they did, and there should have been a follow-up MRI. And they went a step beyond that and told the patient that her problem, which they could see on the MRI, they knew there was something there, was attributable to an old head injury, and that she need not be concerned about it. So her alertness to the problem was certainly compromised at that point.
Yeah, I stand corrected. There was an MRI at that time. So the negligence was in misdiagnosing what was there?
Well, not pursuing it. And two things could have happened then. They could have referred her to a neurosurgeon. These were all neurologists involved in this care. They never did get a neurosurgeon involved. Or they could have followed their plan, which was to get a six-month later MRI, which presumably would have shown some change, and one of the doctors testified to this, that it would probably have shown some change in the size of the growth, which then would have alerted them that there was a problem there.
And there's a suggestion, I think, in the briefs, that prior to 1998, your client was no longer under this group's care at all, that, you know, she just wasn't their patient. And then this relationship was resurrected by the fact that someone from the group was called to the emergency room. Why was she still, what do we have in the record to show that prior to 98, despite the lapse of contact, she was still a patient of this group?
I don't think there's anything, and the same thing could be said back in 94, up until 97. There wasn't a monthly or daily or weekly series of treatments, which would, of course, be the ideal continuum for our purposes. But we nevertheless submit that it is a factual question whether these events, as far apart in time as they are, can satisfy the court's formulation of the rule.
Well, what I have in mind is prior to 98, it's not unusual when someone's being treated for almost anything. You see the doctor, and the doctor says, come back in 6 months, come back in a year, and you do that. But was that the type of relationship that your client had with this group prior to 1998?
Well, as I understand it, she was there when she had these severe headaches. They told her, not a problem, it's attributable to an old injury you had as a child. She has the headaches again, goes back, they don't follow through, and part of the problem is that you have different doctors seeing her each time she goes. And as far as that 97 visit goes, there is a definite conflict whether she failed to follow through and come back, or whether the doctor failed to make the appropriate diagnosis when he first had the chance and order an MRI, which they knew from 2 years before should have been ordered.
You want to save your remaining time for rebuttal?
Yes, I have nothing more to add, John.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Shirk. How are you?
My name is Danielle Urich. I represent all of the defendants' connection with this matter. The facts have been outlined and obviously will be pertinent in the course of this argument. There are two general analyses which Your Honors touched on during Mr. Castle's argument for purposes of evaluating the application of the statute of limitations here. The first is the segmentation. Some questions touched on that, and the Superior Court's ruling in this matter initially determined that each of these treatments were segmentable. We believe that's supported by the facts and by the record and is an appropriate finding.
And when you say by the facts and by the record, that causes me to ask you, particularly when I look at page 22 of your brief, when you set out the trial judge's ruling, as it's transcribed, he says, I look at paragraphs 17 through 19 of the complaint. So when we talk about either the segmentation or we talk about continuing treatment, whatever the correct phrase is, it escapes me for the moment. Maybe I need to see a neurologist. I don't know. I can't remember the exact phrase. Are we talking about his examination based solely on the complaint, or are we talking about his examination of the facts for the purpose of his ruling based upon discovery that had been taken after the complaint and what was in the pretrial order?
As I understand the judge's determination, the paragraphs he was referring to was specifically the complaint, which the plaintiff is bound by. The plaintiff made no efforts to amend that. In addition, however, obviously because it was a motion for summary judgment, records were submitted, including deposition testimony and expert comments. They were relevant to evaluating the course of treatment. The course of treatment, however, the dates of treatment were undisputed. There was no issue of contention as to whether or not Mrs. Stafford, in fact, saw a doctor on a particular day or didn't see a doctor on a particular day. So I believe Judge Tolliver, in fact, looked not only at the complaint to determine what's the period of medical negligence being alleged here and determined that period did not include the consultation of 1998, but also looked at the segmentable treatment dates identified in both the records that were uncontested and also identified in the complaint and in the course of the argument for summary judgment. And in that, he initially determined that each of those treatments were segmentable. The first, obviously, in 1994, no treatment whatsoever.
When you say segmentable, do you mean that they are discrete events that are not connected with each other in any way?
Correct. In other words, they do not fall within the Ewing definition of continuing course of negligent medical treatment. It was not a continuum of treatment. There was no, as Justice Holland pointed out, or in course of questioning, the defendant contends that there was no regular course of relationship or treatment with these physicians. Mrs. Stafford was symptomatic with seizures and headaches and with a history from 1992 on. She then was referred by her treating physicians from the Dover Air Force Base to see CNMRI, the defendants in this case. That was the initial consultation. That was the initial MRI. At that point, it was undisputed that Ms. Stafford was scheduled for a follow-up appointment, showed up, left, never had the appointment. Dr. Penny, who was her physician from CNMRI at that time due to that referral, then called her to explain the results of the follow-up test beyond that MRI and indicated a follow-up MRI should be done in 6 months and every 6 months. That wasn't done. That's the crux of the plaintiff's claim in this matter.
Well, as I understand your response, which is somewhat in the alternative, your first contention is these were three standalone interactions with the medical group.
Yes.
And then your alternative position seems to be if the first contact and the second contact were continuous, the third contact involved no negligence. And when you had a problem during the third visit in the emergency room, you had noticed that your second contact with the physicians was negligent, and therefore you were on notice in 1998 that the time to run the complaint started at your what I'm calling contact number two.
Exactly, Your Honor, that's exactly right. And in fact, not only are they segmentable, as you indicated, but also, of course, a crux of this argument is separating that 1998 consultation. That was, in our position, not even a part. If you get to evaluating these two treatments in 94 and 98 as part of a continuum course, for plaintiffs to prevail, they have to necessarily show that Mrs. Stafford's emergency room visit and the call-in of the attending physician consultation with Dr. Farapapa was necessarily part of this continuum of her relationship with CNMRI, and that is simply not warranted based on the evaluation and the standards applicable to continuum course of medical treatment. So I agree with Your Honor that the continuum course, if you find that these treatments are not segmentable, the continuum course would be from 1994 through 1997. So the last act that you look at is in March of 1997 and not the 1998 act. And secondarily, that's supported by the fact that there is no allegation of medical negligence against Dr. Veerapappa for the consult in September 14, 1998.
Now, you say there's no allegation of negligence. You mean in the complaint?
There's no allegation in the complaint or supported by the medical expert testimony and medical expert disclosures in the course of this litigation.
All right, so when Mr. Castle outlined to us three reasons why he would allege negligence on the time of the emergency room visit in 1998, you're suggesting that the real response to my question about record support is there is none?
There is none. That is the first time that that type of allegation of negligence against Dr. Veerapappa has been indicated. There has been no testimony whatsoever suggesting that Dr. Veerapappa or any of the emergency room physicians acted inappropriately. Mrs. Stafford was brought in with multiple number of medical issues, including being 28 weeks pregnant.
So even if there was a continuous course of treatment through 1998, there's no recovery at all unless the 1998 episode involved negligence.
That's exactly right.
Which you say is not supported by the record?
It is not supported by the record, by any of the expert disclosures.
So your position is in 1998 there was no negligence, but there was notice. If you were going to be concerned in 1998, you should have been concerned about what happened to you in 1997.
Absolutely.
And that's under the continuous negligent treatment doctrine, the triggering event for statute of limitations purpose.
Absolutely. And in fact, that touches on the twofold standard for continuum course. First is which was the last negligent act, which we contend would be 1997. And the second, which I think you're touching on, which is what was her notice, what was her date of constructive knowledge. At the latest, it was the point of her coming into that emergency room with seizures. Certainly she was on notice at that point. But the record also indicates that she was in fact on notice from 1994 through that appointment in 1997. She was advised in 1994 of the finding on the MRI. She was advised she should have a follow-up MRI. She didn't follow up. The allegation is, doctors at CNMRI, you should have called her and you should have scheduled that. That's fine. That is the first date of notice of the act or omission. She then alleges that she continues to treat with these physicians and that she has established a continuum course of treatment and continued relationship with these physicians. But all the while, in connection with this complaint, is now alleging ignorance for 5 years, 4 years, in the fact that those doctors did not schedule any follow-up MRIs.
Why isn't that a jury question?
It's not a jury question because it's not supported by any of the records that have been produced or any of the expert testimony or disclosures that have been produced. The evaluation by this court routinely when determining as a matter of law the date of either constructive knowledge or the date of the last negligent act, where the facts are undisputed and the record is clear such that there would not be an issue that could properly be put in front of a jury, then it can be determined as a matter of law.
Well, let me see if I understand what you just said. Assuming that Mr. Castle's right and there are these allegations in the pretrial report involving Dr. Veerapappa, what you're saying is discovery was completed, everyone had identified their experts, and although this case was ready for trial, there was no expert testimony in the record that said anything in 1998 was negligent.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And the pretrial order...
And so my follow-up question is, even though that was an act by the group, you're saying it wasn't a negligent act, and in the absence of expert testimony that anything in 1998 was a negligent act, then the last negligent act only could have occurred in 97.
That's right. And it's only an act if you decide that it is a part and parcel with a continuous course of treatment with CNMRI, of course. But if you do that, yes, the act that you look for as far as triggering the statute of limitations is the preceding act of medical negligence, which would put you on March 27, 1997, at which time, again, Mrs. Stafford went to the ER first and then was sent to see Dr. Cole. So that would be absolutely the triggering act for the beginning of the two-year statute of limitations. And the pretrial order does not indicate, first of all, the pretrial order is not dispositive with respect to the record developing medical negligence. And Mr. Castle, I know, is relying on that. But the pretrial order simply tries to outline the issues. For purposes of evaluating whether or not the plaintiff could meet her burden of proof for medical negligence, we look to the record and we look to the expert testimony. The plaintiffs identified two experts. The first in the disclosures was Dr. Margulies. Dr. Margulies testified as the standard of care. And what he identified was that the period that the standard of care was breached was the period between 94 to 98 when there was a failure to monitor for follow-up MRI. You've got every 6 months now a known act or omission. The plaintiff is continually on notice for that period of time that she's not been referred. Then you've got the second burden of the plaintiff to not only show medical negligence, which was never articulated with respect to September 14, 1998, Dr. Varapapa, but the second element is that medical negligence, in fact, caused injury to the plaintiff. Dr. Bulos was identified as the expert for causation as far as injury. Dr. Bulos identified, as does the complaint, which the Superior Court referred to in paragraphs 18 and 19, that the date of injury, the failure to monitor, the breach of standard care, resulted in the seizures that brought her into the emergency room in September of 1998. So from that respect, there is, based on the record that was presented at the time of summary judgment, no evidence whatsoever for the defendants to be on notice, nor was there any evidence that the plaintiffs had produced to identify a specific act of medical negligence with causation of injury against Dr. Varapapa in 1998.
So the basis for your motion then was independent of the complaint, independent of the pretrial stipulation. We're getting ready to go to trial, and there's no expert testimony of any negligence in 1998. Therefore, this action's barred.
That became part of the argument, absolutely, Your Honor. The motion for summary judgment was filed based upon, obviously, the statute of limitations, because the last act was at the latest in 1997. Certainly, in the course of that argument, Mr. Castle presented an argument that there was, in fact, negligence in 1998 when Dr. Varapapa was called in to consult. Our argument was twofold. First is, that's a segmentable consultation. If you find that there is medical negligence anywhere on the record to support the plaintiff to continue that claim, then that is the only viable claim that remains in this case. But second, we argued that was not supported by anything on the record. The plaintiff had an opportunity, numerous opportunities, A, at the filing of this summary judgment motion, B, in the course of the briefing. The motion was filed in October of 2002. It was heard in January of 2003. It was ruled upon days before trial in May of 2003. During no period of that time did the plaintiffs move to amend the complaint? Did they move to supplement their expert disclosures to identify specific negligence against Dr. Varapapa in September of 1998? A discussion of an amendment to the complaint was had at the time of the judge's ruling on the summary judgment motion in May of 2003, at which time the judge said, if you want to present that in the form of a motion, I'll hear it.
But the non-amendment of the complaint is of no moment, is it, given that the pretrial order would supersede the complaint? Isn't the real issue whether there was evidence sufficient to go to a jury in the question of negligence at the 1998 episode?
Absolutely. And the expert evidence was not there, and the judge found that as well. What Mr. Castle is now alleging and purported to allege at that time was that there is a claim of negligence against Dr. Verapapa. This was news to us. The defendant's disclosures for experts identified a defense to the treatment in 1994 and 1997. Clearly, it was not on notice that there was a specific claim of negligence in 1998.
So you're saying then that even if there was a belated claim of negligence now in the pretrial order regarding the 1998 episode, it still was not sufficient to defeat summary judgment because there was no evidence to support the claim?
First...
Yes?
Yeah. Well, in part, yes, to the second part. But to the first part, Your Honor, the pretrial order, its defendant's position, does not, in fact, create new allegations or impute Dr. Verapapa's treatment as having been negligent. It says no more than what the complaint said.
But even if you were wrong on that score, it doesn't matter because the evidence isn't there.
Correct. And that's where I agree with the second part of your question, absolutely, that the records are not there, the allegations are not there in the complaint, and the plaintiff was on notice of that at the latest, at the time of summary judgment filing, and never made any efforts to supplement the expert disclosures or put defendant on notice that this was going to be considered either a negligent treatment date, segmentable or not, or part of the continuum course of treatment by CNMRI.
So your position is there's no expert testimony suggesting any negligence in 1998, and therefore it can't relate back, and it can't relate to that single 1998 episode either.
If I were arguing a motion to amend, absolutely, Your Honor. For purposes of the summary judgment briefing and the argument relative to that, it's pertinent as far as, A, segmenting the treatment. Is this a separate, distinct visit with Dr. Verapapa in course of her emergency room admission? And, B, can this truly be considered as part of a continuum course of treatment? And, C, if it is, was it medical negligence? And that's where we get to your point, which is there was no suggestion that this, in fact, was negligent. And secondarily, there was no suggestion by the fact that if this was medical negligence, was there an injury that was proximately caused by that negligence? No injury was alleged by any expert either. The injury was the seizures that brought her in. Had the physicians properly monitored her for the preceding years, she wouldn't have had those seizures. And that's where the expert disclosures come in. And that's the three-part evaluation of why that 1998 episode should not be considered in the course of this. So you have to look back at the last act or omission or negligent conduct, which would put you in 1997, again, bar the filing of this complaint. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the overarching negligence here is the failure to diagnose and treat a malignant brain tumor. That occurred in 1994, 1997, 1998. The fact is they never diagnosed it, and they never ordered the appropriate test to diagnose it, and that's what would be the subject of expert testimony. And I'm sure Ms. Urich didn't do this intentionally, but she referred to the testimony of Dr. Margulies, who's one of the plaintiff's listed neurological experts. My memory's getting shakier, but I am quite sure he was never deposed in this case. And I went back and checked through the docket entries, and there's no indication that his deposition was ever noticed. So I'm quite sure there is no testimony in the record from Dr. Margulies. But be that as it may, the overall testimony would be the negligence is failure to diagnose a tumor, and there were three opportunities to do it.
Well, as part of your response to discovery, I take it you received at least an interrogatory asking you to name your experts, state their opinion and the basis upon which they reached that opinion. And did the opinion of Dr. Margulies, as you disclosed it in discovery, deposition taken or not, indicate that there was negligent conduct when Dr. Verapapa saw the plaintiff in 1998 in the emergency room at Kent General?
I can't answer that, Your Honor, because I haven't looked at it and I don't have it with me. But it could be. It could well be that it doesn't specifically say that. But our position would be that the same act of negligence occurred all three times. And on the question of segmentation and continuum, I submit that those are always factual questions. If I see the doctor today and I see the doctor tomorrow, those are two segmentable events.
But assuming that you're going to go forward, wouldn't you need expert testimony that there was a negligent medical act in 1998?
Absolutely.
And where is that in the record at the time of Judge Tolliver's ruling? Which of your experts, either in a deposition or an interrogatory answer or anything else, said it was a negligent act in 1998?
I can't point to it. Dr. Boulos was the first witness deposed in the case when before change in defense counsel. His testimony was that the lesion was the same, that it should have been recognized back in 94, and that continued through and would have captured all of these, at least by inference.
It's a deposition.
Is
that a deposition?
That was a deposition, Dr. Poulos. We never focused sharply on the 98 negligence because the cause, the damages resulting from that are de minimis, and that's also a fact.
But you can see from our exchange earlier that you can have medical acts that are not negligent, and if you have a medical act in 98 that's not negligent, then the statute's going to run from the last negligent act. And we all agree that you not only need an act in 98, you need a negligent act in 98. So that's the purpose of all three of the justices' questions. Where do we find record support for a negligent act in 1998?
Well, I can't point to anything other than I already have, which is the medical records, the pretrial order, and the testimony at trial, which will be that it was negligence not to diagnose this whenever they had a chance to diagnose it. Now, if it unfolds the way they anticipate, then I guess the case would be appropriate for a directed verdict at the end of the plaintiff's case. But I would not anticipate that based on what the testimony is going to be.
Are you saying that basically the evidence that you say is sufficient to avoid summary judgment as to the 1998 episode would be Dr. Boulos' deposition?
It would, in this sense, Your Honor. He didn't focus and say at this visit in 98 there was negligence. He says it was a deviation not to diagnose the tumor.
Right, and he was talking about all three periods of time.
Whatever. And he probably didn't even know what the three periods were. But the failure to diagnose it was below standard. And then we put that together with the evidence that they had three opportunities to diagnose it.
Any other expert testimony?
I anticipate the neurologist, Dr. Margulies, who had not been deposed, would say that there was a departure in failing to diagnose it and or refer her to a neurosurgeon.
And we'll undoubtedly find that summarized either in your answer to interrogatory or in the pretrial order.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, the pretrial order is in the appendix and refers to 98 repeatedly. I can't represent to the court what the expert interrogatory answer says.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will also have a brief recess.